week of February 13th, 2011, this is Showbiz Sandbox Episode 92, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
You know, I got a letter from a reader, or I guess an email from a reader, earlier this week that said we should mention that you can email us at the head of the show. So you can email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's D-I-R-T at showbizsandbox.com. Or you can call us, 888-567-SAND. Of course, we're not taking calls live here during the show, but we can play them on next week's episode.
You know, shows like Showbiz, like Oprah and other shows, they have the after show online, or like Bill Maher on HBO. So Real Time with Bill Maher, you have the show on cable, and then when the show's over, they switch over to the internet and they have a little bit more show. Maybe we could switch over after the end of our podcast. We could switch to like NBC and have the rest of our show where we chat and take viewer phone calls and things like that.
Yeah, actually, that would be not a bad idea. In fact, if you are online, you should subscribe to our podcast either via RSS, or you can go to iTunes or the Zune Marketplace and you can subscribe there, or any podcast reader, really. But you know what? I don't want to take too much time out to plug ourselves, because we have a packed show today, specifically because the Grammy Awards were last night. We're going to be going through them as thoroughly as we can, and that means a lot of talk about Justin Bieber. Okay, and actually, what it really means is we'll be talking to Rolling Stone contributing editor David Wilde, who worked on the Grammy telecast, and we're also going to be talking about another award show over in the movie world, the BAFTAs. We're going to be telling you who all the big winners were. Of course, the Broadway musical Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark continues to make headlines, though, like Lindsay Lohan, not all of them are good. Of course, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines during Big Deal or Big Whoop, but first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on some new Justin Bieber news during the weekend's box office.
It's Justin Bieber's world. We just live in it. I guess that's the message this week. The number one film at the box office was a nail biter. For the moment, it looks like it's Adam Sandler's Just Go With It comedy with Jennifer Aniston. It grossed $31 million over the weekend and should do great on Monday because of Valentine's Day. Number two at the box office is Justin Bieber, Never Say Never, his documentary/concert film, which grossed $30.26 million, just less than $800,000 behind the Adam Sandler film, a tremendously big opening for a concert documentary film, just a tad under the Miley Cyrus Hannah Montana concert film, well ahead of the Jonas Brothers. It's a big, big opening. Be fascinating to see how it does next weekend. Number three is Romeo and Juliet, the family animated film with music by Elton John. That grossed $25.5 million. Number four is The Eagle, a Roman epic with Channing Tatum and my favorite, oh my gosh, Jamie Bell. His name slipped my mind for a second. That movie grossed $8.5 million. It's definitely a disappointment. Number five is The Roommate, which fell hard, starring Derek Jeter's girlfriend, Minka Kelly. That grossed $8.4 million. But it's grossed $26 million total and only cost $16 million to make, so they'll probably be showing a profit. Number six is Oscar hopeful The King's Speech at $7.4 million. It's at $93 million in the U.S., just a tad below $100 million. Number seven is No Strings Attached at $5.6 million, Sanctum at $5.1 million, True Grit at $3.7 million, and The Green Hornet at $3.6 million, still struggling to get to $100 million.
Well, it's struggling to get to $100 million here in the United States, but overseas it's made $107.2 million. And notably, overseas this weekend, The Green Hornet had the widest opening ever for a film in China.
Oh, well, that is interesting. How much did it make in China? Do you know? I shouldn't ask because I don't know if you know that.
$11.5 million US. Of course, it's different in Chinese yuan.
They made $11.5 million US in China?
Yes.
Wow.
Now, remember, a lot of films don't get released in China. A lot of US films do not get released in China for political reasons, and for it's a closed market effectively. But you know, the China market is really going through a multiplex boom, so they need content, they need movies.
Well, they need about 80,000 screens to handle the billion people in their country.
Well, that might very well might be true, but they will of course mostly show homegrown content.
Well, I know. I think they'll open up more and more. I don't think you've got American books and CDs, and there's no reason why movies shouldn't ultimately be in China too. But of course, that would take loosening up of the country's political system.
And also tightening of the piracy laws and enforcement of the piracy laws, because really that's the big problem there, is that it hits the screen one day and it hits the street corners the next.
Well, it's also a cart before the horse. I mean, there's a huge piracy problem because most movies aren't available. So,
okay, fair enough,
you know,
fair enough.
You know, if movies were available legally, I always believe people are happy to go see them the easiest way possible. They don't need to steal. They're forced to, and certainly in China that's the case. I wonder how much of that $11 million is going back to U.S. I'm sure whatever the deal was, they're probably getting only a sliver of that sent back to the film studio.
Well, yes, because you know, getting money out of China is notoriously difficult, if not impossible.
Well, there are companies that do business in China and make a lot of money, but it's very complicated. And when you're new into a market, it's hard to get a good deal. Anyway.
Right. Now, did you see any movies over the weekend?
I didn't. I was finishing my best CDs of the year list and seeing some theater. So I wanted to see the Justin Bieber, but I felt a little pervy. So I'm going to wait until like Monday or Tuesday when there aren't 8,000 screaming girls in the theater.
Well, I was actually there with 8,000, well, okay, more like, you know, 50 screaming girls. I went to see Justin Bieber because my daughter, 5-year-old daughter, was invited to a birthday party. And the party, this just should just give you a, kind of an inkling or a feeling for what kind of kids my daughter goes to preschool with, or I guess now she's in kindergarten. The invitation for this birthday party came, and it had a picture of the birthday girl with Justin Bieber.
Sure, she photoshopped herself in. Why not?
No, actually, quite the opposite. No, she met Justin Bieber. And,
this was not like some fan thing. This was a plugged-in kid.
Yes, a plugged-in kid. And so we went to the movie theater with, you know, 30 or 40 of her closest kindergarten friends. And as we arrive, my daughter asks, so this Justin Bieber guy, he's what, like a rock star? And I was like, do I start to try and explain the difference between rock star and pop star? Yes, indeed. He is a rock star. And
how was the movie?
You know, I was dreading it, but I have to say, maybe because I went in with such low expectations, I actually thought witnessing it or watching it as a kind of an academic spectator that it was fascinating because it really goes through all of his backstory and how he rose to fame in under a year. I mean, this is a kid that in 2007 was discovered by Scooter Braun, his manager, on YouTube. Scooter Braun flew him to Atlanta where he met Usher, which was shown on the Grammys last night. And that scene is also in the film. But it really kind of shows how he was this family kid being raised by his grandparents and a single mother. And he just had a knack for music and wound up, you know, making it big thanks to, in large part, and this is the part that fascinated me, his entourage, this machine behind him, which, by the way, is why the movie is so slickly produced. I mean, this thing was produced to within an inch of its life, much like his music, by the way.
Well, I suppose if you're over 20 years old, that story might be unfamiliar to you, but it's gotten good reviews and it's gotten pretty darn good reviews from critics who've all said, hey, you know, it's actually more substantive than you would expect and pretty interesting and pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of is very touching and it's really about this kid who sees Taylor Swift at Madison Square Garden and turns to his manager and says, 1 year from now, we're going to sell out this place. And indeed, he winds up selling out Madison Square Garden, which is where the concert footage was filmed. And, you know, there's the drama of his throat and his vocal cords being injured on the way there and whether he'd actually be able to perform. But it had, you know, little cameos from Miley Cyrus and Ludacris and Jaden Smith, Will Smith's kid. Really, as I was watching this film, all I could think about was what's going to happen to this kid 15 years from now when all of these, this whole entourage that doesn't need him anymore because they've moved on to the next Justin Bieber, where is he going to be?
Yeah, well, you know, it's always hard to transition from a child star to adulthood, especially if your career doesn't go with you. He could be one of those rare people that makes the transition like Stevie Wonder. It's not a given that the Jonas Brothers are done with. Miley Cyrus, Hannah Montana, that actress could still be going on strong. You know, there's no reason why they can't make the transition. It's hard, but hey, you know, fame and fortune at any stage of life is hard to deal with. And if you're lucky enough and have a good background, you can survive and go on to other careers and do other things. But, you know, if you watch the film, you do think, gee, this guy's pretty darn talented. I don't know that it's clear he's a flash in the pan. He's not writing a lot of his stuff yet. He's writing some of it, but not a lot of it. But as he does more and more of that, he's branching out into film. Will Smith is looking for film roles for him. He's pretty good at comedy. I've seen him do a lot of skits, and who knows what'll happen. People can have second acts and third acts. I wouldn't write them off yet.
Write him off. I didn't even really know much about him until I saw that film over the weekend. And really, he comes out on stage, and I just wanted to buy that guy a belt and maybe some shoes that tied. because
all right, now you're showing how old you are.
Well, actually, it's funny you should say you should mention that, because there were a whole bunch of adults in the audience who were there with their kids, and they just could not stop laughing at all these girls screaming on screen, of course, in the film, and saying, "Oh, Justin Bieber's my next boyfriend. He's, you know, he's, I'm going to be his first wife. You can be his second."
They didn't scream when in the audience that you were watching it with?
Just for fun, really.
Oh, okay, cool.
But, you know, my five-year-old, who didn't know who Justin Bieber was going into the movie, won't stop singing that baby, baby, baby song now.
Is she? Did she watch the Grammys?
No, Michael, my daughter did not watch the Grammy Awards because she was asleep. But, you know, I know you watched the Grammy Awards, and I certainly watched it. And joining us now is someone who worked on the Grammy Awards. In fact, if you've been listening to this program for any length of time, you'll know David Wilde as the contributing editor for Rolling Stone. And, of course, the author of He Is, I Say, How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love Neil Diamond. David Wilde right now is driving from the Staples Center in Los Angeles all the way to the Kodak Theater, where he will be working on the Oscars. So from the Grammys to the Oscars, I don't know how you have time to even join us, David. Thank you for taking the time to speak with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
David, when do you know if the show's a success for you? Do you wait for the ratings? Is it the performances during the show? Is it the after party? When do you, for yourself, decide how successful the show was?
Well, it's a very interesting question, because there's a phenomenon in television that I think people outside of live TV don't know, called show love, that after a show, almost inevitably, everyone feels it's always been a success, and then the next morning sometimes you find otherwise. But this is a unique challenge this year, because last year we were up, I think it was like 35% in the ratings. It was an astronomical, giant leap. And so the great news is that's amazing. The bad news is you have to follow it up. So I just talked to the executive producer, Ken Ehrlich, and we were thrilled, because the show did better than, you know, I just read Variety, the highest in 10 years and best in demos in 10 years. Whatever it is, it's one of those success stories that, frankly, in television, you don't hear enough of those. So we're thrilled.
Well, now, the telecast that you helped write, it kind of spread the awards around, although we all kind of thought that maybe somebody who had Lady in their name would win a few awards. And in fact, it wasn't Lady Gaga. It turned out to be Lady Antebellum, a country music act that won Best Record of the Year, Best Song of the Year. I know they won, I guess, Best Country Album.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, was that a surprise for you?
Well, first of all, I've been writing Lady Gaga, Lady Antebellum jokes now for like six months to a year. I had a lot of fun with that at the CMAs with Brad Paisley, who's our host, and Carrie Underwood. And so I'm actually kind of amazed that people are surprised. Lady Gaga did win. She won one on air, and I think she won a couple maybe in the pre-tells. I guess I'm not surprised by that at all. There's a lot of America between New York and L.A. that aren't as much, they like Lady Antebellum, and they're not necessarily, you don't have to be in a translucent coffin to be charming.
Hey, David, I was wondering what the mood is like backstage for the industry overall. I mean, we've been reporting for a little while about, you know, music sales are dramatically down. You can have a number one album and it sells only 40,000 copies, which is kind of mind boggling. Does that make the Grammys, which is this huge platform, and obviously the ratings are up, does that make it even more stressful and big a deal for these acts than ever before? Or what's it like for them?
You know, it's an interesting question. I think the truth is, A, it makes the Grammys feel more important, because it is the biggest platform to sort of, you know, bring music to the masses and keep artists working and keep artists making money. Obviously, it's harder to do the show, because quite literally the money to produce it and put the numbers up and the sort of traditional, you know, way that the record companies help support the whole endeavor, it's all changing. Yet I think in interesting ways, it's sort of helping people return to make great music, because it used to be people, you know, had record deals that were so profitable and they delivered records almost as contractual obligations. I get the sense that anyone who makes an album today is making it because they really wanted to say something. And so you get this weird, I mean, I thought the show last night, I love the eclecticism of the show. I think it literally is kind of mind blowing in rehearsals. Saturday, we went from the rehearsals literally went from Justin Bieber to Bob Dylan to Mick Jagger, and I'm saying this is just wonderful. And CeeLo, I think I love all of it, and I love the idea of musicians actually getting a the world stage a platform to sort of show what they can do.
Now, was it true that you actually helped CeeLo pick out his outfit?
Yeah, I'm his dresser. No, I think there were, it's fair to say that that was sort of a nice surprise even on us, to us. And I mean, in rehearsal, the number was unbelievable. I personally thought the background singers brought it in a way background singers never have. I love that number. I have to tell you from a personal point of view, that was my happiest moment of the night because, you know, when you put Jamie Foxx, who is very funny, to introduce that number, you know, you have a script that gets very close to words that would get you in trouble. It was very nice to, you know, everyone actually, you know, stayed. I'm glad nobody got hurt.
whose idea was it to refer to his song "F.U." as the song otherwise known as "Forget You"? Because I thought that was genius.
I think that was, believe it or not, to me, it's a great comical decision. I mean, I wish I could take credit for it. I think it was actually the Academy in all their paperwork sort of trying to figure out how to handle this. I happen to say, you know, I'm a parent. I have two young boys. I actually prefer "Forget You." I actually like it better because I like it. I can play it for them and not feel like I'm being corrupting influence.
Well, you know, he came out wearing this big feathered plume, like peacock outfit. And then Gwyneth Paltrow showed up. I guess she sang the song on Glee. And now she's a big singer, I suppose, she did a good job.
I'll tell you, the amazing thing is, as I happened to weirdly work on the CMAs where she appeared and sang, the Grammys where she appeared and sang, and, you know, she's going to be on the Oscars, which it's amazing to me that I never would have guessed a year ago that I would have worked on those three shows and that she would have sang on all three. I don't think anyone would have seen that coming, but I think she's wonderful.
Yeah, she did a great job. I mean, I would question her decision to get up on that piano in those high heels, but you know, she pulled it off.
Listen, I got to tell you, I had the same heels on and I never would have gotten up.
No, that's very, very hard to do. I've done the same thing, but this does raise the big question I have. CeeLo had a very elaborate production with puppetry and all that sort of stuff. You had Barbra Streisand with a full orchestra. You had Justin Bieber with about 20 dancers and musicians and people going on and on and on. There were so many elaborate productions. One, I don't know how the backstage even worked. People must have been standing outside. And two, literally, I'm wondering who pays for it. Like Mick Jagger coming out to do a tribute to Solomon Burke. He's not pushing an album. I don't know if his label's going to pay for it. Is the show? He had 25 people on stage, I think. I mean, who's paying for these elaborate production numbers in this era where music labels have so little money?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I'm not a line producer. I know that it's harder and harder to do, and there's tougher decisions made and things that, you know, there wasn't any staging with Mick. It was Mick. And there was Raphael Sadiq and his band who were amazing, who I don't think, you know, I don't think anyone's getting rich off of performing on the Grammys. And,
They got to rehearse, they got to practice, they got to people got to be paid to show up and play their.
Well, I'll give you an exclusive. Here's how it's done. I think I overheard a conversation where Mick offered to cash in frequent flyer miles from the Stones tour to get him to be there, and he was there not for the wrong. He was there for the right reasons, to pay tribute to one of his influences, Solomon Burke. So I think that I got to tell you, I just was talking to Ken Ehrlich, and I said, Ken, you know, at Woodstock they didn't have Dylan or Jagger. We had both last night. It's like, it's kind of amazing that these people came through. Dylan is my hero, and I blogged about him on Huffington Post a couple days ago about, you know, what it was like to have my hero play the show. And I just think as music, as you know, you talked about the industry sort of, the traditional industry sort of collapsing. I think there is the desire for music and the passion for music has never been greater. As witness, you know, look at how many people watched the show last night. Paying for it seems to be another matter entirely. And that's difficult, but our love of music isn't going away, and live music isn't going away. But it's just sort of the delivery mechanisms are, I think they'll be in transition for years to come. You know, I'm as big a music fan as I know, and even I don't listen to CDs that often. I tend to random shuffle, and, you know, I tweet at Wild About Music on Twitter, and every day I do a song. And the way I really do it is I wake up in the morning and in bed with my wife, not to wake her up, I put on my headphones and I put a shuffle. And that's really how my musical universe goes. It's random. And I think that's what's hard, is in that world of songs rather than albums, the traditional, you know, way the industry worked, it's just not working. But music isn't. Music still works as well as. And last night, you know, I think you sort of saw that in many instances.
Well, we also saw, as you mentioned, Lady Gaga in an egg. And I mean, she came out and there were two moments. Well, three moments. One was with Rihanna. One was with Justin Bieber. And one was with Lady Gaga, where I wondered, these people must be lip syncing because, I mean, they're running around and they're jumping around. How do they keep their voices steady during all of that movement? I mean, are they?
I don't think any of them were lip syncing. I think there was there was sort of a talking part of Gaga's thing that she must have been triggering somehow. But as far as I could tell, absolutely. She's a real singer, and she showed that last year when she sang with Elton John. That was just, she can pull it off. I don't think there was anything at all lip sync that I could tell with Eminem at all. Cause Rihanna, you know, it wasn't perfect, but it was definitely real and it was powerful. I thought
the Eminem vocal sounded really weird to me too. It sounded like it was lip syncing as well for him, which I was surprised at because the sound level was just so perfect and pure and never varied a moment. It just didn't sound like a live sound. It sounded like a studio sound. But I assume you can't tell us, even if you wanted to, if anyone or who was. I assume that would be a thing that would be inappropriate for you to divulge.
No, and I would tell you, I don't think that goes on at the Grand. I think when people really sing, that's not my, you know, part of the show that I'm involved in. But I was there as a music, and I'm a recovering music critic. It all felt real to me.
The one thing that I really hoped you could give us the backstage skinny on was Arcade Fire, because they won Album of the Year, which was a big news. I mean, I think the last time an actual rock band won Album of the Year was probably U2 in 1988, if you don't count Dylan or Steely Dan. And for an alternative young act, it was a real breakthrough. And they won, and then they said, we want to play another song. And then they just went back on stage and started to perform a second song because they just performed right before Album of the Year was announced. And it felt very spontaneous. And was it just that the show was a little short and they had the room, or how did it come about that they did that?
Yeah, my understanding is basically it was just because the unique thing of having the band, you know, they were nominated and they were the last, their stuff was up there. You know, I think there was just a discussion like if we had time and if we were sure they could play us off, because, you know, over the credits and everything that it's cool to have music. So it was, I think, thrown out there as a possibility, but no one knows who's going to win. And I think it was a long shot I think it was, you know, no one expected this to actually happen.
What I love is that they played Ready to Start as the last song.
I love that. No, as a fan of the band, I wanted to hear that so badly. I thought it was great.
Yeah, I was a little surprised they sang Month of May, although in retrospect, yes, it makes sense. It's a song about recording an album, so it makes sense that they would sing that as their Grammy song. And I know we talked about Lady Gaga already and Rihanna, but what struck me about their performances is how little they were wearing. I'm just shocked at some of the female artists, the younger female artists, because of course Barbra Streisand came out in this beautiful gown, and then Lady Gaga comes out in 15 different outfits, but the one she wore during the performance was barely there. Does anybody make mention of that?
Well, no, the thing is, Lady Gaga, even those of us who are around the show, like, you can't quite figure out what the hell's going on with her. Like, she, you know, when I said coffin before, she literally came down the hall, passed me by in a coffin, a translucent coffin, not that thing she entered in, not the egg. A coffin. Like, each time she came into the venue, she was in a coffin. So it's kind of hard to get to know in that. You know, people in coffins are hard to get to know. And those outfits, we saw different things in rehearsal. But yeah, I can't explain Lady Gaga. I'm not sure who could. Rihanna wore very little. I wish I'd been watching more closely.
Well, now, we talked about Justin Bieber at the head of the show because his movie did fairly well over the weekend. And, you know, it seemed to me that, you know, you said people don't make millions performing at the Grammys, but certainly their careers can be propelled by performing at the Grammys. And it looked to me like people were really kind of amazed at that performance. It was Justin Bieber and Usher on stage, and as well as Jaden Smith, Will Smith's son. It just looked like people were kind of really taken aback at how good it was.
And when I say that people don't get rich, I mean, we don't.
Oh, yeah.
I think that it does propel careers. I've seen it a million times. I mean, like, you know, Ricky Martin, who was on last year, his career was made by a Grammy performance that made him a star years ago. That was, you know, before he had hit records. I mean, outside of purely the Latin market. But time and time again, I've seen, you know, people have used the show to kick off big tours like Simon and Garfunkel or The Police. It is a great platform, but it's just, you know, we don't have the money to pay them.
Right.
But if they can get there and we can get them there, I think they can have a huge impact. Even like Mick Jagger, I think last night, as big a star as he is, that performance to me reminded people that this guy is still just the best at what he does.
I mean, everybody was on their feet and they were all like looking at him in awe. It was pretty amazing to see the audience responding.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, no, everyone. And I knew that would, I had a feeling that would happen, but the guy was just on fire. And, you know, even Bob Dylan to be at his stage, and he's my hero, and to stand there with two great young bands, and, you know, I thought he was phenomenal the way he was like channeling George Clooney, no brother. He was proclaiming Maggie's Farm. I just loved it. I loved him sort of taking, you know, this is the godfather of all folk rock. And there he was. It was just amazing to me.
That was the musical highlight for me. Mumford & Sons did their song The Cave, and then the Avett Brothers did their song Head Full of Doubt, and then they all backed Dylan on Maggie's Farm, and they looked so happy to be there. The grins on their faces were just wonderful, and they were all great in their individual numbers. I thought it was a real big point. Another big highlight for me was Bruno Mars, B.O.B., and Janelle Monáe. I thought those were another three young acts that really showed themselves as showmen and really good live performers.
Oh, Bruno Mars, when he did that sort of doo-wop version of with Grenade, he's the real deal. He's one of those guys that in any era he would have been a star. And, you know, he's like about 4 inches shorter than I am. I just love, you know, I've introduced him to my kids at some show recently and like they were towering over him. And yet the guy's a monstrously large talent. The guy, I just think he's amazing. And I'm not that familiar with Janelle Monáe. And I think
her album is great.
Amazing. Yeah, she's
great. Her album is terrific. The Arc Android, one of my favorite albums of the year. It's absolutely sensational.
Yeah, she's great.
A number of the acts, I had a problem creatively where they would do two or three numbers in a medley. And I felt like I wanted somebody to just do a number and let it, you know, and kill it.
Yeah, a lot of times you have to understand that part of it is there's with the nominations and all and trying to reflect those, you're trying to get as many of the nominees onto that stage as possible. And that's part of sometimes the reason. And sometimes it's amazing, like the Bruno Mars B.O.B. Janelle Monáe number. That's, you know, it was an attempt to get, you know, three of those exciting young nominees in one place. But, I understand what you're saying. On the other hand, there's probably a few million kids who are very happy to see Jason.
As a writer at an award show, I noticed there are times where somebody who is presenting an award kind of flubs their lines or maybe they're nervous. I don't know. I mean, do you ever kind of go back and say, well, maybe I could have written that better so that they didn't trip over it? Or no, that person just wasn't reading properly. Do you think about those things either as the show is going or afterwards?
Oh, yeah. I mean, obviously, but there's always, you know, it's like writing the Grammys, there's people who are just, there's always going to be someone drunk, someone with questionable reading skills. That happens all the time. But for the most part, actually, people deliver, you know, there's people who you always know are going to be great. Like, if they're saying, ladies and gentlemen, Neil Patrick Harris, you're never worried. If they're saying LL Cool J, you're never worried. These people know what they're doing. There's other people who are never going to be that good at it. But, you know, you survive. And, no, yeah, I don't write the flub, so, you know, they don't blame me for that.
Did anybody go off script where you were like, oh, geez, I wish they hadn't done that? Or, hey, thank goodness they did that.
Yes, I had no complaints with anyone yesterday with that.
Yeah, it looked like Keith Urban kind of gave John Mayer a couple daughters there. I thought that was funny. He kind of said, well, not your daughters, but, you know, the song daughters, you know.
That was great. In fact, that was something I was very involved in that. And I was in the room when we were sort of working out that Jolene, where they were working out that Jolene. And I love that. And I always try to write that into the show. People just, you know, right at the mic, instead as they present singing something. And those three were just great to me. And, yeah, I actually loved Keith sort of kidding with him. And you could tell John Mayer was not going to be detoured.
No.
He actually referred to, I'm going to stay on the script. I think he he's learned some lessons, from, you can get yourself in trouble when you go too far off script. But I thought that was great.
Yeah, I was going to ask if you were driving Nicole Kidman from the Staples Center over to the Kodak Theater there, because, of course, last night we saw her dancing around to Katy Perry and singing along with Katy Perry. And, of course, she's nominated for an Academy Award, and you're working on both shows. I thought, well, you know, carpooling.
Yeah, no, there's actually, believe me, there's more crossover than that. There's, there's the fact that Florence from Florence and the Machine is going to be performing on the Oscars. There's and Gwyneth Paltrow is as well. So yeah, there's a shocking amount of crossover actually.
And now you have to practice your jokes about stuttering and maybe the movie Inception and True Grit.
There's a team for the Oscars, and I'm happy to be part of that. And we've already done a lot of. I have to say, with actors and the Oscars, it's more buttoned down. More, there's a lot of work that's already got a lot. I've already done a lot of the writing. I will do, and I got more. We got more to do, but it's going to be great. Don Mischer and Bruce Cohn, who are the producers this year. Don, I've worked with on the Emmys the past few years, which have been wonderful. You know, I would park cars at the Governor's Ball, but now I get to go, so that's exciting.
Now, between the Grammys and the Oscars, do you ever show up at home and your family calls the police because there's an intruder in the house sometime in January and February? I mean, is that how do you live?
Well, this is I've done the Oscar pre-show for I've never done the main show. So yeah, this is unusual in that it's been very busy, but I live very close to the Kodak Theater, so this is going to be very nice.
Well, certainly, we know you're busy, and thank you so much for taking so much time to talk to us about the Grammys. It was a fantastic show last night. I really enjoyed it. I think the 26 million people who watched last night, I'm sure they feel the same way. And break a leg on the Oscars.
Oh, thank you very much. No, and thanks for having me on.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Bye. And we should say, Michael, that David Wilde is on Twitter. And if you're not following him on Twitter, boy, are you missing out. There was backstage pictures being sent out by David on Twitter. And he really does every day give you one person to talk listen to. That's usually somebody I've not heard of or somebody that's up and coming. It's well worth following him on Twitter. Wild About Music is his Twitter handle.
Absolutely. And if you go to our showbizsandbox.com and check our show notes, you can find a coverage of every single performance on the show and a rating for it. And there's also a link to my piece in Huffington Post that I wrote over the weekend with my top 50 albums of the year.
Yeah, let's talk about that for a second because, all right, so you have top 50. I got top 10 here in the show notes, but...
Well, I didn't put them all in there. I just put the top 10.
Okay.
But the link will take you to everything if you go to Huffington Post.
You know, the one thing we forgot to ask David about was... the Best New Artist, which went to Esperanza Spalding.
Right. She's a jazz artist on the Concord label, which is a small jazz label that used to be the home of Rosemary Clooney late in her career. And it's sort of indicative of the year. Independent labels are really the future for music. I mean, you're seeing major record labels being sold off. They don't know what to do. Indie labels are where it's at. The last 3 years, an indie label has won Album of the Year, the big kahuna. This year, it was Merge Records, who are the home of Arcade Fire. Last year it was Big Machine, which has Taylor Swift Fearless. And the year before that it was Rounder Records, which had Robert Plant and Alison Krauss's Raising Sand. So Esperanza Spalding's on the Concord label, and it's just a sign of the indie labels, small companies with a passion for music who have low overhead. That's the future of music.
Well, you know, going over your top 10, do you want to go from the top or from 10?
Well, 10, you'll see a lot of the acts actually that won Grammys are acts on my list. So people make fun of the Grammys a lot of times. Certainly, you know, there are some bad choices over the years. But when you get into the categories like world music and jazz and country and bluegrass, there's a lot of great music there that you can find. My number 10 album of the year was Mumford & Sons' Sigh No More. They obviously performed on the show with Dylan. They were great.
Then 9 was Keith Jarrett and Charlie Hayden.
It's a terrific jazz album called Jasmine, just a lovely, beautiful Pacific album. Number 8 was the follow-up album by Midlake, who topped the Rolling Stone or was near the top for the Rolling Stone Paz and Jop Award for their last album, The Trials of Van Occupanther.
Isn't that the Village Voice, Pop and Jasmine?
Village Voice, yeah. Village Voice, thank you. Their last album was wildly acclaimed. This one, The Courage of Others, is like British folk from the 70s, and people were not into it, but... the album that they sort of worked on that is very much like Van Occupanther is by John Grant, an artist that they sort of adopted and worked with and helped produce. And his album, Queen of Denmark, is just gorgeous. Named number one album of the year by Mojo, I think, in the UK. Just a terrific, lovely 70s FM radio vibe to that album.
And then because we're running long on time, I'm just going to read through some of these. Number seven, you have Eminem and Kanye West, their two albums, Recovery and My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy, respectively. Number six.
Right, and Kanye West will probably be up for a lot of Grammys next year.
Right. Buddy Guy is at number six for his album Living Proof, which is a blues album. Janelle Monáe for The Arch Android and Erykah Badu for New America Part 2, Return of the Ankh. Then the album of the year, Arcade Fire's The Suburbs, comes in at number four. And then number three, you have a kind of a world music act, Ali Farkatoure and Timoni Diabate.
Yeah, and they won World Music Album of the Year, just like Buddy Guy won Best Contemporary Blues Album of the Year.
Right, and then number two is a bit of a surprise, Peter Wolf for Midnight Souvenirs.
Well, it shouldn't be. He's from the band, the Jay Giles Band. He's been solo for many years. This album got a ton of press and attention. Rolling Stone, everybody had major features on him. Everybody loved the album, but it sort of fell off people's radar. Did great live performances. He and Jay Giles Band got back together, did some shows in Boston. They were just, he had a great year, but people just forgot about him. I'm not sure why.
Well, a band that a lot of people may not know about, but certainly should, is The Tallest Man on Earth. And they come in at number one on your list for their album, The Wild Hunt.
Well, it's just a guy.
I know. I was going to say technically it's not a band, but...
Is he Austrian, Swedish? I forget what Scandinavian countries he's from.
I think he's from Sweden.
He's from Sweden. He sounds like Woody Guthrie.
It's amazing.
He sings in English. He sounds like Woody Guthrie from the heartland of America. He does acoustic, folky, Dylan-esque is the inevitable comparison. And he's released a string of EPs digitally and albums. I mean, he's just this little act in the middle of Sweden that sounds like an Americana act. And he releases his albums digitally. And, you know, he's reaching the world. And it's just a terrific talent. But this is music now. You know, EP, digital-only albums that sort of make his name. He has two proper full-length albums. He's in Sweden. He has no major label. He has no music videos to speak of, but he can reach the world with his talent.
And he's going to be at Coachella. I mean, he's one of the artists at Coachella.
Yeah, and when you're good, people will find you.
Speaking of artists that are performing these days, just a little quick update on the LCD Sound System retirement concert. Apparently, tickets went on sale, I guess it was Friday. I don't know when, but... they all went to scalpers. All the good tickets went to scalpers. And James Murphy is just raging mad about that. And they're thinking of adding shows if they haven't already. And he was on Twitter asking if anybody got tickets. And when they didn't, he was really upset at StubHub because they had all these tickets at really hyperinflated prices. He sent out a tweet that said, you know, we are not worth paying that much to see.
Well, you know, StubHub is just a secondary market that lets people sell tickets in a secure manner. I use it for Yankee tickets. StubHub is not the people he should be angry at. They're just a clearinghouse. They're not making money off it either, except a percentage of sales. He should be angry at the people who bought the tickets and then posted them on StubHub. But if you want to stop that, just tell people they have to have their ID when they come to the place and they have to pick it up.
It's funny that you say that because, you know, Arcade Fire was in town for the Grammys here in Los Angeles. And last Friday night, they did a secret show. It wasn't so secret. Everybody kind of knew about it, but they didn't know where it was going to be. And so on Twitter, the band would kind of send out these tweets with a zip code here in Los Angeles and then a link to a picture. And the three pictures were in the 90036 area code, a picture of the King of Spades. And El Rey is the king in Spanish. And in that zip code, that postal code is the El Rey Theater. Well, then there was a picture of Origami in 90026, which is where Origami Records is. A picture of a fingerprint in the Long Beach postal code, and that's where Fingerprint Records are. And so those three places are where you could pick up tickets, and that was the only place you could find out where the show was. They didn't tell you where the show was unless you bought a ticket, unless you were one of the few people that got in.
Well, that's fun, but that's not the way to deal with a show that's at Madison Square Gardens.
No, you could never do that for Madison Square Garden.
But there are ways to make the person who buys the ticket show up with their credit card and their picture ID in order to claim the ticket. It's very simple.
Bruce Springsteen did it. Bruce Springsteen did it, and it worked out really well.
Yeah. So stop complaining, LCD. Grow up and do it right. Sell it so people have to show up at the venue with their credit card and or their picture ID.
Now, speaking of tickets, do you think that ticket sales will be hurt for Spider-Man, Turn Off the Dark? I always feel like I have to do that, even though Karen Woodward is no longer on the show. Do you think that the early reviews, all of which were negative, will actually hurt that Broadway musical, which is still in previews and has yet to actually premiere?
Well, there are movies that are critic-proof. Transformers and, you know, movies like that that make $300-400 million, even though critics didn't like it. There's no reason why there can't be Broadway shows like that. And there have been long-running Broadway shows that audiences liked but critics hated. It doesn't help. And it'll take us a few weeks to find out how much it's hurt. Right now, it is the number one show on Broadway. The description from people how much it costs to run it every week goes every time somebody retells the story. It costs $800,000 a week to run it. $900,000, $1 million. I just read $1.2 million. So they just keep raising the ante, people picking these figures out of the air. If it costs $1 million a week to run, they're grossing $200,000. They're netting $200,000 a week, which is profit. It'll take them 4 years to, you know, break even, but it's profit.
Right. I mean, the show costs $65 million to put on. And, you know,
it did. And the plan was always to make money on the road. But those reviews were brutal, weren't they?
Oh, they were awful. And of course, they came before the show actually opened. And a spokesman for the show, Rick Miramontes, I hope I pronounced that right.
He's of O&M. Yeah.
Yeah. He says changes are still being made and any review that runs before the show is frozen is totally invalid. But still, I mean, I think the New York Post, they had a story headlined Dark Sure to Be Turned Off, and they're talking about really just how awful the show is and how, you know, it's Julie Taymor run amok. There was no creative producer to rein her in, and that this is the end of her career as a Broadway musical director. I don't necessarily know about the end of her career. Certainly it might put her back a couple of years and she might not work in Broadway musicals for a while, but if this fails, it still hasn't failed. But I think people are already beginning to predict the end, so much so that the article points out that, and I'll read this from the New York Post, as for Bono, he's washed his hands of this fiasco. When he finally got around to seeing it, he knew it was a mess, sources say, which is why he didn't bother to write any new songs. Instead, he headed to Davos, Switzerland.
Well, he already, of course, had an engagement at Davos at a conference, which he was expected to attend. So the fact that he went to Davos is not telling in any way. He had to go. He was already committed to it. But and I doubt that the theater critic at the New York Post has good contacts with U2. But anyway, the show's not doing well. They say the advance on sales is only $10 million, which is not a lot. You know, musical on Broadway, 5 months from now, we'll get a sense of how long it's going to run and whether audiences are going to go anyway.
Yeah, there's
but you can run for a year or two and it's not going to make a penny. You know, if they close in a year, they're going to lose their shirt.
I mean, so it's such a part of the media circus at this point, or the news cycle, that SNL, Saturday Night Live here in the U.S., they did a skit about a law firm that specializes in representing audience members injured during performances. And what do they get? Not money. They get extra tickets.
That's funny. It's yeah, and I think the complaints that critics reviewed it early is a little weak. At some point, when you're open for 2 months, 3 months, you know, people are paying money, and reviewers can go in and check it out.
So you're saying then the reviews really don't matter? They're not a big deal.
It's not a big deal, but I see where you're going. You want to segue to big deal, a big whoop, but I think you've forgotten about the BAFTAs.
I totally forgot about all of our movie news. In fact, we'll probably have to, you know, we'll cut one story and move it to next week about AMC and Regal. But and we'll see if there's any fallout from that. But I know you want to talk about the BAFTA Awards, which were held in London at the Royal Opera House over the weekend.
That's right. I didn't watch the awards on TV, but the King's Speech was the big winner. And really, the winners of the BAFTAs, I don't think they've ever mirrored what people think might be the winners at the Oscars more than they did. It looks like we've just seen the Oscars. The King's Speech won Best Picture. Colin Firth won Best Actor. Natalie Portman won Best Actress. David Fincher won Best Director for The Social Network. True Grit won for Best Cinematography, which I think will happen because of Roger Deakins. King's Speech won Best Original Screenplay. Social Network, Best Adapted. Toy Story 3, Best Animated Film. On and on and on, even down to the Tech Awards.
Helena Bonham Carter.
Well, I was going to get back to that. On and on, down through the Tech Awards, it really looks a lot like what will win the Oscar. The only area of contention is supporting actor and actress. King's Speech won both of those. Helena Bonham Carter and Jeffrey Rush won for supporting actor. Those are wild cards. I think one or both of them could win it at the Oscars. There'd be a great sign that King's Speech will win Best Picture if Jeffrey Rush wins Best Supporting Actor. Could be Haley Steinfeld for True Grit and Supporting Actress, but I think there are possibilities. And really, when you look at this list, it just feels like a dry run for the Oscars.
Yes, yeah, I would agree with that. Although I do think the American Society of Cinematographers over the weekend gave Wally Pfister, the cinematographer for Inception, their award for the year. So, you know, between True Grit and Inception, one of those will win cinematography.
Yeah, and Inception will be a player in the tech categories. One argument that people have is that when you give a really good acceptance speech at the SAG or the DGA or the BAFTAs, that helps you get an Oscar because people want to hear that speech again, or they grow to like you even more. And if that's the case, Helena Bonham Carter did herself a lot of favors because she gave what a lot of people thought was the most charming acceptance speech of the night for her win in The King's Speech. If Oscar people were paying attention, that might give her a little edge. So I think it's a big deal that she won and gave a good acceptance speech.
Well, thank you very much for giving me that little hook to transition into Big Deal or Big Whoop, our segment where we discuss the top entertainment news stories of the week and whether they are a big deal or if anyone should care about them. Our first story is about The Daily. Is the app-only newspaper The Daily, from Rupert Murdoch, having growing pains or is it dead on arrival? Media Week reports that the initial app had all sorts of problems. The second version, meant to correct those problems, gets even worse reviews on iTunes, where readers complain about it being buggy and slow or not working at all. One Daily person, posting a comment, blamed the readers for not downloading it properly. You need to delete the first version before downloading the second, unlike most apps, which just overwrite the old one. Others just found the content lame. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. It's bad to launch your product and have it be in such a shambling shape. You can get away with it when you're a small company and nobody's paying attention. But when you're The Daily and you're the first app-only newspaper and everybody in the country's reporting on it, it's a good idea to get it right the first time.
Well, I actually saw some video from The Daily, which was about the Winklevoss brothers, who, if you've seen The Social Network, they were, you know, in The Social Network as the two twins that sued Mark Zuckerberg over that. They were interviewed by somebody who grew up with them. And I thought, conflict of interest much?
That's how they got the interview. Was it any interesting or was it dumb?
It was interesting in only that they did not come off very good. The twins, that is. I actually kind of went, you know what? If I were Mark Zuckerberg, I would have stolen your idea too. Is Pandora green? We're not talking about the James Cameron world he created for the movie Avatar. We're talking about the red-hot personalized radio service that owns about half the market for internet radio. The people behind it believe now is the time to cash out. You know, before it's turned a profit. And they're looking to see an IPO, or set an IPO, later this year. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. You know, the economy's starting to turn around. Pandora and internet radio and music is, the hot action in the music world. So this might be the right time to strike.
Yeah, and maybe they only lost $300,000 last year, which I know it's still a loss. But
Yeah, that was down from a $60 million loss the year before.
That's right.
And their revenue went up like 80%.
Right.
So
like, I think
they're on the right track.
$90.1 million in revenue, and 60% of that goes to pay royalties. So it's going straight to the record companies and the musicians.
Right.
Yeah. Nat King Cole wasn't just one of the best-selling musical acts of all time. He was also a pioneer in television. The Nat King Cole Show was the first primetime show to be headed by a major black artist when it debuted in November of 1957. It never scored big ratings and ended after only a year, but it attracted a bevy of talent and is still a landmark show. Now it's getting released again on iTunes. Yes, a show that at one point might have come out on VHS and later on Laserdisc or more recently on DVD is coming out strictly on iTunes as a digital download. You can buy an episode for $2 or rent it for $1, with 4 episodes out on February 15th. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal as far as the idea of a major property coming out only digitally. But when people realize that these episodes in the first few months of the show were only 15 minutes long, I think they'll be a little disappointed when they pay $2 for 15 minutes of a TV show. It's the entire episode, but it's a little chintzy. But clearing the music rights must have been a bear, and to see it come out just on iTunes is definitely a hint of the wave of the future.
Hewlett-Packard is coming out with its own tablet this summer, a year after the iPad, and probably around the time Apple comes out or at least announces the iPad 2.0. But here's the interesting fact. Time Inc. will be the quote-unquote exclusive publisher for the tablet, with titles like Time and Sports Illustrated available via online subscription. Time Inc.'s CEO Jack Griffin has been the most vocal about Apple's no info for our publishers and no annual subscription policy for readers. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal that iPad is getting competition. It's a big deal that they're trying to open it up to publishers and be friendly to them and allow them to have subscriptions. I don't know why any tablet would want to have an exclusive publisher. Does that mean you can't access other stuff via their tablet? That seems like a bad idea.
No, but that means that, you know, Sports Illustrated and Time won't be on the iPad.
Yeah, that seems like a bad idea too.
Yeah, I know. Well, exclusive content, I mean, it just, don't get me started.
Sports Illustrated should be on every platform they can, and Hewlett-Packard shouldn't limit themselves to just one publisher. So it's bad on every level. Makes me far less interested in their tablet.
Zooey Deschanel is coming to TV. Did you know that?
No.
The film and indie rock darling of She and Him has committed to a Fox pilot about a single, unlucky in love elementary school teacher who gets over her latest breakup by moving in with three juvenile guy friends. Maybe they'll call it She and Them. Or The Little Bang Theory. Meanwhile, Ricky Gervais is high on the idea of putting Arrested Development star Will Arnett into the office. Apparently, they didn't get Arnett's last sitcom, Running Wild, in the UK. Are these casting tidbits a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Actor gets role. That's a big whoop, according to Karen, so I'll stick with her on that one.
Okay, well, yeah, Karen Woodward never liked the whole actor gets role thing. I will say this. Zooey Deschanel, who is kind of an independent movie darling and, you know, does a lot of film acting, going to TV is kind of a big deal that she's kind of taken herself off the movie market, but she can do movies during a hiatus, I suppose, and technically it's only a pilot, so doesn't really mean much until it's picked up. As far as Will Arnett goes, who knows? I mean, that's just Ricky Gervais mouthing off again.
Well, but he's the executive producer on The Office. I don't think he has a big day-to-day role in the show, so I don't think he has a ton of weight, but I think it matters a little bit.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, Zooey Deschanel's sister is Emily Deschanel, and she's doing quite well on Bones, so...
Yeah.
It's back to the air guitar for music fans. Video game company Activision has laid off some 500 employees and pulled the plug on Guitar Hero. The second iteration of the game, Guitar Hero 2, was the first single title to hit $1 billion in sales. But Activision isn't done. They also have the blockbuster title Call of Duty, whose latest title grossed $1 billion in 6 weeks. But is this the last waltz for Guitar Hero, a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. This was a genre people were like crazy about. Everybody was trying to launch their own version to have it, you know, it was a fad as it turned out. The idea you need to buy the whole extra instruments and stuff, it just made it very expensive to enter that genre. And it proved to be the fad I thought it would be.
This entry on Big Deal or Big Whoop is brought to you by BP Petroleum, cleaning up your world for a better future. Documentary filmmaker Morgan Spurlock stumbled onto his best reviewed idea since Super Size Me by making an entire film about product placement. The official title? Palm Wonderful presents The Greatest Movie Ever Sold. He's extending the idea to the promotion of his movie by selling promo rights to his upcoming talk at the TED conference as well. Is this a big deal or a big whoop? Wait, by the way, the really big deal is down at Big Bob's SUV Extravaganza. All SUVs are marked down 20, 30, and even 50%. Come on down and check it out. That's Big Bob's SUV Extravaganza on Highway 61, just past the mall. Michael?
I think it's a big whoop, but it's a clever extension of the whole concept of the movie, so more power to him.
He's an interesting guy. I went to college with him, and he certainly does know how to market, and he certainly knows how to pick one of those ideas that just kind of clicks with the public. And I love
You're friends with him?
You know, every once in a while we'll exchange emails, but...
But you knew him?
Yes.
Ah, cool.
He'll be back. Start working on those lame Austrian accents. Arnold Schwarzenegger has finished his community service in California and wants to get back to acting and the big bucks that go with them. Schwarzenegger tweeted to fans that he'd given CAA, Creative Artists Agency, the green light to field offers. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, I think it's a big deal. He's been away long enough that people sort of miss him as an actor. Looking at his film career, though, you know, he had a very smart transition from action films to some comedies like Twins with Danny DeVito. But it'd been a long time other than Terminator where he had a hit movie.
That's true.
He owes a lot of his career to James Cameron, True Lies and Terminator and Terminator 2 and that whole franchise. Outside of James Cameron, it's not too good of a list.
So you're saying the last action hero, not a good movie?
Exactly. But, you know, people want to see him. So I'm sure he'll, you know, he needs to get the right movie and launch himself again. You know, this could be his real chance at a second act.
Remember our story last week about the UK show Top Gear and their attempt at humor when discussing a Mexican car by saying it would be lazy and feckless and so on? The BBC rather adamantly defended the jokes by saying, basically, that's how we roll in the UK. Stereotypes of entire countries and cultures is part of our grand tradition. Well, BBC America, the US cable channel that carries the UK version of Top Gear, yeah, they're not quite such the staunch defender of that. They've confirmed that when the episode airs in the US this week, the offending comments will be edited out. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop as far as people will forget it a week from now, but very smart of them to do it. There was no way they should have played that on the air when they had all that advance warning.
By the way, the United States just a little bit closer to Mexico.
Exactly.
Geographically. Well, that concludes Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into Inside Baseball, our segment where we discuss the stories that only people in Hollywood might care about. And if you work in Hollywood or even follow it somewhat loosely, you'll probably know who Scott Rudin is. He's a producer who's produced thousands of movies. I mean, he's very well known for two things. One, producing really great films that are often literary based, but also for kind of being a bit rude to his assistants. And by a bit rude, I mean notorious. There's an article in the New York Observer that goes into it. But he's now closing his Los Angeles office and moving your way, Michael, to New York.
Right. And of course, he's in New York a lot because he's also a major Broadway producer. So wanting to, you know, he's been back and forth coast to coast all the time. Production deals at studios are sort of fading a little bit in importance right now. People are sort of off them. They want to save money by not having a shingle based on their lot. So that might have something to do with this as well.
Well, and his shingle was over at Disney, where he made a lot of films for Miramax. Originally, he was with Paramount. And there's speculation that, you know what, he's going to wind up going over to Sony, where he made The Social Network. And, you know, that probably is true, because Amy Pascal, who heads up Sony, is kind of a big fan of, you know, literary adaptations. So that wouldn't surprise me if he wound up there with a deal. And maybe this is just, you know, a step towards that. Of course, as you mentioned, he does Broadway shows. And this season, do you know the shows he's doing?
Well, he's got like four shows on Broadway, which I think is the most he's ever had. He has a revival of John Guare's The House of Blue Leaves, which stars Ben Stiller and Edie Falco. He has a show we've talked about before starring Chris Rock called The Motherfucker with the Hat. Oh, I'm sorry if you have kids in the car. Sorry about that. He also has a show brought over from the UK called Jerusalem, which is a terrific drama with Mark Rylance, one of the best actors alive today. Next season, he has a Tennessee Williams revival called Sweet Bird of Youth with James Franco and Nicole Kidman, which I think is a bad idea. But the biggest property he has, I'm really excited about, is the South Park people are coming to Broadway with a show called The Book of Mormon, and I can't wait to see it.
Yeah, that does sound like it could be a laugh riot, but I don't know, how are they going to get all those paper cutouts on stage to move around?
I can't wait to see it. It's going to be good. It's not a South Park-based musical. It's an original musical, not set in the world of South Park. So you won't have Kenny and all those people on stage. But it's really, you know, I can't wait, because their movie musical was one of the best of the past decade. And he has good taste. He seems to option half the books that get published in the world. He always has the rights to books before anybody else has even read them. And be interesting to see him based in New York. I think this is where more of his heart is right now. Meanwhile, if you're his assistant in L.A. and he says, hey, come to New York so I can harass you there, or, you know, make your life miserable there, I'd say, you know what, try and find a new job.
Exactly. We're running a little long on time, so we're going to skip over listener email for this week. But if you want to email us, you can. The number to call, the email address to reach out to is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you could call us and leave us a voicemail. That number is 888-567-SAND. 888-567-7263. Of course, you can subscribe to the podcast, as I mentioned at the head of the show, in iTunes or the Zune Marketplace or in your RSS reader or any podcast catcher. If you want links to any of the stories we've discussed in today's show, you can find them on our website, showbizsandbox.com. I'd like to thank David Wilde for taking a lot of time to speak with us today about the Grammy Awards and the upcoming Oscar Awards, which he will be working on. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by MGMT, the popular indie rock group who can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, it's michaelgiltz.com, and he can be found on Twitter, at Michael Giltz is the username to look up. David Wild's Twitter account, one more time, is at WildAboutMusic. My Twitter account is at Sperling, and you can find some of my writing on Celluloid Junkie. Until next week, play nice.